Session number 23848, Mill 12.
It was interesting. I mean, I'm all surprised even now that, you know, Algeria have never. I know they had all this trouble, but you'd have thought by this time they'd have thought of having tourists. And it's a place I should like to go back to. But we didn't have many hours there. There were cinemas, of course, and the cinemas, which is an interesting thing, I've always thought. It's funny how the Americans seem to be exporting films to all over the world, even during the war. We saw Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire in a in a French version, French dubbed version of one of the American films. And I often wonder if they also exported films to Germany. It's a thing that's never been researched, I don't think. What did the Germans watch during the war at the cinema? Did the Americans, in fact, send them films, or did they make their own and watch their own? But has anybody ever thought of that? I don't know. But we did. We went to the cinema wherever we could, and invariably the screen came towards you, because you were drunk when you were watching. But and we also had one in the local cinema in the local village of Maison-Carry, where the lights went up about 10 minutes after the programme started, because the local mayor was coming in and had to take his seat in the middle. At they were very light, all light entertainment. There was no political stuff at all in any shape or form. But,
now, you mentioned that the Hotel Aglietti was offices only. How do you think your draft of men, how were they occupying themselves? Was that kind of segregation?
Yeah, they went to estaminets, and I suppose, in a way, a lot of them were limited because they had leave trucks or trucks to go into Algiers. I can't really remember clearly how we used to get in there. I know we used to walk back often. I mean, it was 7 or 8 or 10 miles, 12 miles back. I've forgotten, but we invariably used to get a lift. You flag them down. But how the men did, I don't know. There were some local facilities. There was the odd auberge, whatever they call them, inns, and so on and so forth. And of course, there was also Naffy on site.
What was the food like at this stage in Maison-Carry?
It was probably a bit better than it had been in England, because you got a lot of corned beef, of course, and but you could get bread and a lot of fruit. We were advised, for instance, eating dates, to open every date to make sure there wasn't something in him, and certainly make sure that oranges and that sort of thing, lemons or citrus fruits, were properly peeled, and watch out for rogue traders. So in that respect, of course, it was a thing that nobody had been used to, and they were only too pleased to get their hands on.
And so there was a lot of trading with
And eggs. There seemed to be an abundance of eggs. I don't know where the hell they got them from, but all these Arabs seemed to carry eggs, and they were cheap. And I suppose, in some extent, the men made their own arrangements of cooking extra food themselves.
Was there any trouble with... I mean, other veterans have talked about, kit going missing and theft, and apparently there's quite a little bit of illicit trading as well of kit from certain army units to the Arabs.
I only ever came across theft once, and that was when I had something pinched, when I was in the ranks, but... And the chap who I knew had pinched it, but couldn't prove it, came to me and he said, I've had something pinched as well. But it was only, it was a lot of money, 2 bob or something like that, 2 shillings, bits and pieces. There was a bit of pilfering of equipment, for when you had to have kit inspection and make sure yours was up to date. People did pinch other people's, if they could. But it wasn't a great problem, to my knowledge. The only other problem I did come across was the occasional men who had a little bit more money, who used to lend money to their comrades and charge them ridiculous interest, you know, as much as almost 50% a week. And that came to the attention of the commanding officer at the time, and a stop was put to that. But, you know, they'd lend them, they'd borrow two bob and want 4 shillings back the next week, sort of thing, which was a hell of, which was a bit, well, I mean, when men got into that position, there was no way of getting out of it. But there were those who tried that on. But I suppose if it was pinching at all, it was purely equipment, rather than have to pay for it afterwards. And of course, when it came to things like laundry, you in England, you send off, or the men sent off their laundry, I think it every week, and you never got the same shirt back. I mean, these laundries used to work on the principle that what we're washing now can go out to refill what is coming in. So it was on a, you know, the dirty stuff came in, they washed it, then it was ironed and cleaned, and it went back to the unit, and then it was shared out again, you see, so you never got your own stuff back again. But, and things like blankets never got washed, as far as I never remember anyone ever washing a blanket. You had weekly blanket shaking. Shaking blankets by numbers, more or less, you see. And
Are there any kind of medical repercussions to that, you know, skin allergies?
Well, the main thing was impetigo, a blanket rash, and people used to get lathered with the gentian of violet and come out of the MO's office looking purple. And of course there was the famous number 9 pill, which was supposed to be more a laxative than anything. I was saying, number 9 pills keep moving. But, and the grades were, of course, M and D, medicine and duty. And then category B, I think you're allowed time off until your next medical, which is probably the next day. We had to report to the MO. But, and then if it was M and D in red, it meant that the bloke was malingering and you'd have to watch him in future.
But, was that, about how many cases like that would you have come across up to this point in your career? I mean, as an officer, rather, you know, in the 60s and then as...
Well, you'd always get, in a platoon, you get 4 or 5 a day. They were generally genuine. I mean, they were all minor complaints. When we got to Africa, we started getting dysentery, and but mainly through eating fruit and that sort of thing that they hadn't been used to. But then again, there were cases, I believe, when the men did it on purpose and tried to get it because you couldn't. You see, there was a whole different atmosphere. We'd been, not brought up, but we had this idea, you know, people who in the First World War deserted were shot and they were put in prison and this, that, and the other. In the Second World War, they took the view that if a man didn't want to serve, he was no damn use to anybody, and the sooner you got rid of him, the better, because it was no good for morale. And so a lot of men got away with it, rightly or wrongly. But to keep them, there wasn't any point. And so in that respect, it changed.
With these men that you had at this period, there was no kind of anybody kind of going absent without leave or anything like that, was
there? No, there was nowhere to go. Well, there were cases of men who went native, so I've heard, who sort of disappeared, and whether they ever... whether it was women involved, I don't know, but what the hell they did in a place like Algiers, I don't know, because they were pretty... whether the rumours were true or not, there were cases when men got stabbed by Arabs and a night business, used to, you know, the last one got... And they certainly, in the front line, they dug up graves to take the uniforms and equipment off dead bodies. I mean, that certainly happened. The natives, the Arabs themselves, they weren't exactly trustworthy. But so, of course, that, to a large extent, helped to cement the comradeship between the men themselves, because they were on the lookout, to guard each other to a point. But it wasn't a great problem at all.
So you're at Maison Carree. What happened then? Mm.
Well, then we got the order to be posted, and there were Lincoln officers in the compound, and I thought naturally they'll go first, but Joe was, I was selected to go with my men, and we boarded these trains in Algiers, which were 14 men and 8 horses, still stamped virtually from the First World War. The last carriage was reserved for baggage and officers, so we had a compartment with a toilet, and that plate on my toilet came from the Algerian train, actually. It came back in my kit years after the war. And
how did it get back?
I unscrewed it when I was on the journey, off the toilet door. But I bet that train hadn't, and that's when we met the Americans, and a lot of swapping went on between the men with souvenirs. And when we pulled out of Algiers, I reckon within 10 minutes or a quarter of an hour, there was a man sitting on a buffer with a bucket with holes in it, with a fire going, cooking on it. Where the hell they got the coal from, how they got it lit, I don't know. But we sort of chugged along. We're on that, I think we're on this train 3 days. It's about 800 miles, I suppose. And it used to pull up in the midst of nowhere for no apparent reason, a single line track, apart from at stations when there was a double. And no sooner did we stop than heads appeared from all over the landscape, and Arabs congregated with selling us eggs and things. A problem was water. Whenever it stopped at a station, we had to detail blokes to go out and get water in buckets. We slopped around quite a bit. I can't even remember how we got fed. I suppose I can't remember eating, but we must have done. I think we must have had ration boxes and opened them up. But sometimes the train used to stop, and it would be there probably 2 hours. And we pulled up at about the third day, and into this station, and we detailed a batman of the York and Lancs officer, that I call Stead. And he got off the train with 2 buckets, and he got them filled, and no sooner he got them filled, the train starts to move. And the last we saw of this lad, he got a singlet on, and trousers, and gym slippers, and 2 buckets of water. And he came tearing down the racetrack, and we said, well, throw the water away. He threw the buckets of water away, and he chased, and he missed the train. And that was the last we saw of him. Until about 3 days later, we were at a staging camp, and he was brought back by the military police. And he'd wandered off looking for somewhere, and found an American anti-aircraft unit, who immediately decided to keep him as their mascot. And they took him to Constantine, and they fitted him out in American uniform and gave him a Colt 45 revolver, and said, we're going to keep this guy, you know, as our mascot. So they went to the RTO in Constantine. They were officers, American officers, and they said, we've got this guy here, I forgot his name now, and we want to keep him, you see. So with no more to do, the RTO divested this man of his gun and his uniform, and told the Americans that they couldn't do such a thing, and sent him back to the unit. And he was most annoyed to having lost his thing. The strange thing about that man was that The day I was wounded, this fellow Stead, the Yorkshire Lancs, the Hampshire regiment, where he was in, was wounded, as I was, and he was eventually killed. And when they went to retrieve his body, this man, this boy who'd run the water, was his batman, and he was dead. He died of shock beside him. There wasn't a mark on him at all, and I thought it was rather sad, really, because you don't often hear of that, but he was... the officer was wounded as I was, and they kept shooting at him, but they killed him. And in fact, I remember when I was finished, I heard them say, "Lieutenant Stead's dead." Although he had nothing to do with us, he was in another battalion. And they found this fellow's body beside him. But he's another bloke you don't forget. Anyway, we went into we stopped at a place called Souk Aras, which was in still in Algeria, where we detrained, and we stayed there a night or so. Yeah. And then we moved on by train through very beautiful scenery, mountain scenery, to a place called Sukalaba. Yeah. Got a picture of that somewhere.
And you're looking at an old postcard.
That's Souk Aras.
And this is a postcard you bought at the time?
No, this is a postcard I found in a bombed shop in Tunisia. I haven't got those. Well, I've lost those. There's one that had one of the stations somewhere, but anyway. Anyway, we then went to this place, Souk. Sukalaba, which was a holding camp, a transit camp. And all of a sudden, I found myself the senior officer, as a second lieutenant, with 1,000 men under my command. And we had them on parade in the morning. And the sergeant major said, "What are we going to do with them, sir?" And I said, "Well, they've had enough training." I said, "Tell them to run up to the top of that hill." It wasn't very high. And I said, "When they come down, they're off duty for the rest of the day." And I've never seen men run so fast up that hill and down again. And I went into this small town with another couple of blokes. And we went to have a Turkish bath. I didn't allow them to massage me because they were tearing these men apart. But we had a tremendous Turkish bath. And when we came out, there were some Arab boys who polished our shoes, boots. And we wandered back to camp. And when I got there, one of the officers who had trained me at Sandhurst in the guards stopped me. He came in, he was drafted into this place, and he said, "Who's in charge?" I said, "I am." He said, "How did you manage to get this job?" I said, "I didn't manage." I said, "It just happens that I'm a senior officer here." And we said, "Do you think there's a chance?" All of a sudden, this wonderful training officer that I met in the guard had become very worried about his own safety and wanted to know if I knew a way that he could stay there as an officer. And I thought, well, that just shows what you lot are like. And I went back to the lines, and they said, "You're moving." And I said to the batman, "How many eggs have we got?" "We've got a dozen eggs." I said, "We'll eat all those." So we ate a dozen eggs between us. And we drank a lot of whiskey to get rid of it. And then we were put onto trucks. An officer said, "It's a very pretty journey," he said, "going up the mountains." And I thought, well, I can think of something better to do than that. And we duly went off towards the Tunisian border and into Tunisia, and as darkness fell, there were, you could see gunfire on the horizon, and all of a sudden you realised what you'd let yourself in for. It was surprising how it sort of, I think it's focused your attention on things. And we stopped at a checkpoint. There was a military policeman there, and he said, "We'd like a cup of tea." And I went in and had a cup of tea, and he said, "It's lovely out here." And I thought, "Yes, all right for you, mate, sitting here with a fire and a cup of tea." And we continued on through the night, and the gunfire was getting heavier, and the flashes were getting brighter, and we eventually rolled up and stopped in this village called Jebel Abiod. I didn't know where it was. And I thought, crikey, we're back in Flanders. It was completely shelled. There was virtually hardly a building standing. There were, actually, but at the time, I remember it was just a junction, road junction, with shell buildings all around and rafters sticking out of the sky. And I said, "What the hell am I supposed to do now then?" And a chap said, "Well, you go up that road, sir, and see if you can see any troops coming back." And we started at about, well, I don't know what time, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, in two files, one on either side of this track, and we marched forward into the night until eventually we saw some soldiers coming the other way who were Lincolns, and the officer, his name was, I didn't know it at the time, Major Barrell, his name was. He said, "Is that you, Jeff?" And he was referring to this Jeff George, who was a Lincoln officer. And I said, "No, it is I, the foresters." He didn't seem all that pleased that he was getting replacements from other regiments. But we were told to go to a farmhouse and get the men under cover in stables and a pig's byre. A cow buyer, and get your head down, which we did. And so I went to sleep that night with the gunfire in the distance. Well, it was quite near, actually, but and wondered. It's only what I did think of was, of all the men who'd been in the Western Desert for the previous years, and we'd just let them be there, and all of a sudden we were in the same position. Why on earth should we be here? It was quite different to, you know, what you had envisioned it would be like. Don't say you were frightened particularly, but you wondered how on earth you got into the position when you'd let yourself get into that position, if you know what I mean. We probably don't.
So did you'd mentioned this man that you knew at Sandhurst?
Yeah.
Who, like, engineer and
yes, he was
an easy job for back from the front line.
Yeah,
he was. So were those thoughts going through your mind that maybe?
No, I didn't. I mean, I was prepared to do what I was told to do. Funny, but he's on that photograph. I've forgotten his name. But he was in the Scots Guard. Remember that? That no, I thought it was that strange that he, who had been a training officer, should sort of want to find a cushy job.
So that was your first night with the Lincolns.
Yeah.
What happened the next morning?
Well, the next morning I went to see the I think it was the company commander, Major Barrell, and he just asked me who I was and where I'd come from and where the men and all the rest of it. And he said, "I'd like you to take out a patrol tonight." He said, "I want you to go up that mountain over there, hill, and see if there are any German troops coming around that way." I suppose he gave me something to occupy my mind, I don't know. So I arranged, I asked for volunteers for a patrol, and this friend of mine, Alan Holmes, volunteered as usual. And there was a fellow called Beddoes, and there was one or two others, and one or two I detailed as a reconnaissance patrol rather than the fighting patrol, and I told them to assemble at about 11 o'clock at night, and we'd go off.
Could you just define the difference between a reconnaissance patrol and a fighting
patrol?
Reconnaissance
patrol, you went out really getting information as to enemy positions or anything like that. A fighting patrol, you went out with the intention of stirring it up a bit.
And what would be the difference in terms of what you would take with you on a
reconnaissance? Well, having learned from my experience at Sandhurst when I was told off roundly, you take all the weapons you can.
For both, for a reconnaissance patrol as well?
Yeah. Because if you're stuck, you've got to have some weapons with you. I'd only detailed one Bren gunner, and the rest took rifles and grenades, I think we had. Anyway, when the time came to assemble, again, it wasn't stupid. It was, to me, it was the most obvious thing to do. The Bren gunner didn't turn up. And it was dark. I mean, you couldn't see a damn thing. Not like these war films where people can see at night and read people's records. You couldn't see a damn thing. And you couldn't light anything. I remember saying, mind these bodies, because the first time I ever saw corpses, they were one or two had been killed, and one was a second lieutenant, who they said had only just got married before he left, and he'd been shot a lot. I don't know what his name was, but I said, well, mind those bodies in the sort of garden where we were putting them, and we duly started off. Well, what we had to do was, first of all, we had to cross a road, then we had to cross a railway line, then we had to cross a river. There's a river Sedgenane. And at midnight, in the dark, when you're crossing a river, you don't quite know what you're letting yourself in for. But actually, I went in, and I was lucky enough to find that it was ankle depth, and we all got across it. It wasn't a very wide river. It was probably, 10 yards. 30 feet? Yeah, something like that. And we then proceeded, as per book, with me in the centre, with a leading scout at the front, or two, and two on either side, and one behind me. And which is as I had been told to do it, you see, because you're supposed to have control of your men. Well, what happened was, in effect, was that the bloke in the front, a fellow called Starbuck, every time he said, there are lights, sir. And, of course, these lights were glowworms and fireflies and God knows what. And I kept running into the back of him because he'd stop, you see. And I'd keep going and run into the back of him. And we were... So I said, well, I'll lead. So I led. And we went up, started going up this bloody great hill, and we were... Stones were clattering and dogs were barking and glow were glowing. And after about an hour, and there was no sound, I mean, the noise we were making, if there'd have been any enemy there, they'd have known we were there.